This is a BloomerBoomer.com podcast with host Andy Asher.
Well, hi, everyone. I hope you're doing okay. You know, you think your job is tough. What if you dealt with customers? In this case, they're actually medical patients, all of whom practically suffer from pain. Now, there's no two ways about it. It's going to get to you, right? Well, today we speak with a medical doctor who does just that. He deals with people's pain. This is actually the second time we've spoken to Dr. David Hanscom, an orthopedic spine surgeon in Seattle. Just listen to what he says, because it'll surprise you. It may even anger you, but it makes you think.
That many people really do not want to give up their pain. It's a very powerful tool. People use it as a bit of a weapon. They hide behind it. There's a lot of power behind pain and the anger that goes along with it. Also, anxiety and anger are one of the symptoms of what we call the mind-body syndrome. It's really a neurological diagnosis, what I call essentially phantom brain pain. We get these obsessive circuits spinning around that aren't necessarily rational, and I can't break through it. So one of the symptoms of the disease of mind-body syndrome actually blocks the treatment. So that's the part I simply have not figured out yet.
So those traits or characteristics in themselves block the treatment.
Right. The essence of the program is awareness and connection. And when you're angry and upset, you really aren't aware. You think you're aware. In fact, that's one of the perverse nature of anger, is that you think you have really clear vision of everything that's gone around you. But really, when you're angry and upset, it's really just about you. It's really your interpretation of the world. So it's very difficult, if not impossible, to really hear what other people are saying.
So let's explore that a little bit. It's fair to say that you're an authority on pain. Now, I've been a runner for so many years, and I experience pain down my leg that's been diagnosed as sciatic nerve pain. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to me, there's three sources of pain. One of them is a structural problem, which is a pinched nerve with matching symptoms. The second is soft tissue pain, which is tendonitis, inflammation of the muscles and tendons. And the third part of it is, or third source, is simply what's called mind-body syndrome, where the pain, where the brain literally short circuits. And pain circuits that should not be on are now on. And when the switch is on, you feel the pain not in your brain, but in that body part where the switch goes to. In other words, when you turn on the light in a room, of course, the light goes on, not the switch, right? So let's say you have a painful knee and your brain is short-circuited. Well, the knee itself could be causing the pain, but also the switch in your brain that goes to the knee could be on without an injury in the knee, but you still feel the pain in the knee. The sciatica is interesting because that's the most common reason I do surgery. Usually that's a structural problem with a bone spur, for instance, on the S1 or 5th nerve root. And when I take the bone spur off, the symptoms go away probably 95% of the time, unless the brain short-circuited. For instance, my wife's mind-body syndrome, and she and I both have her own set of symptoms, is she has L5 sciatica down the side of her leg. It's terrible, terrible pain. It's horrible. I have scanned her twice. Her spine is completely normal. I did not used to think that sciatica was a mind-body syndrome symptom until I dealt with her and now other patients, whereas the leg itself can light up. In other words, that nerve, the switch to that nerve has lit up. And when she goes to the same tools that we both talk about, her sciatica will go away. Now, when you're having sciatica and running, that sounds a little bit structural to me. So really, by chance, if we did an MRI scan of your back and found the bone spur, then surgically removed it, there's a pretty high chance you could go back to running.
Wow, that's encouraging, but, you know, I'm not the only one, I'm sure. Whenever anybody tells you about back pain, they say, oh, don't go and get surgery.
Well, you know, I'm a surgeon, so spine surgery has a bad reputation, and it actually deserves it. In other words, there's a lot of spine surgery done for back pain, and when you don't know the exact source of the pain, and you do a surgery anyway, it simply doesn't work. So the analogy I like to use, if you go to the dentist with mouth pain and you don't know where the source of the pain is, you start doing random procedures, the chances of solving your problem are essentially zero. If you go to the dentist with a painful cavity and you take care of that cavity, of course, the result's essentially 100%. Spine surgery works very, very, very well if you can see the problem that matches the symptoms. It's really incredibly rewarding both for me and the patient. So, again, it really depends on the diagnosis.
So, not to put words in your mouth, but are you saying that surgery is done at times without knowing what the source of the pain is? That seems a huge surprise to me.
Well, probably most spine surgery today is done in that regard. In other words, let's talk about spine fusions for back pain. So it's really interesting right now, and I just wrote an editorial on this I'm getting ready to publish, is that we know that disc degeneration is normal. In other words, it's not degenerative disc disease. It should be called normally aging disc. And research has shown multiple times that there's actually no connection between disc degeneration and back pain. So that's the first thing to consider. So there's about over 300,000 or 400,000 surgeries done a year for back pain. The success rate of a spine fusion for back pain is about 25% to 30%. That's not very good. And then the chance of having a reoperation on that spine is about 18%. Then there's actually about a 40% chance of going into what's called a failed back surgery category, which means you have chronic pain the rest of your life. The chance of creating a failed back syndrome is actually higher than the success rate of the surgery. So with back pain, you have a normally aging disc. The surgeon somehow decided this is worth fusing, and it's actually been shown not to be a source of pain. It is probably one of the most common reasons we perform spine surgery today. It's a huge problem. Second variable is there's over 1,000 research papers documenting that there's a poor correlation or poor connection of outcomes in the presence of anxiety. And we do know from the mind-body syndrome diagnosis that pain is really always connected to anxiety. And we look at anxiety as a neurological issue, not a psychological issue. So pain pathways and anxiety pathways are always connected. Anxiety is more of a mental reflex. So we know that in the presence of anxiety, as long as the anxiety switches are on, since they're connected to the pain switches, it's not psychological, it's just an interaction of pathways, that the chance of the pain going away is very, very low. Yet a paper out of Baltimore showed about a month ago that only 10% of surgeons right now are assessing and treating anxiety. And it's a big problem. And of course, pain makes people anxious, and people have pre-existing anxiety. We also know that mental pain and physical pain are processed in the same part of the brain. So it's very, very tricky. So what's happened to me personally is that about 18 months ago, our staff decided that, well, anxiety is a bad prognosticator. For elective surgery, we simply are not going to perform surgery until we decrease the anxiety. We now have about 21 patients with significant structural problems that I actually had on the surgical schedule that as their anxiety dropped, their pain threshold went up, the pain disappeared. They never came back for surgery. So we're getting ready to publish that paper here in the next 6 months or so. So even in the presence of structural problems, as you calm down the nervous system, the pain can still go away. It's fascinating. So right now we have this epidemic of spine surgery on normally aging spines, and we have high anxiety, which is a poor prognosticator. So if you combine surgery on normal spines in the presence of anxiety, it's sort of a nightmare.
Yeah, you're not going to cure a problem in the head that's you're feeling in the back, are you?
Right. Right. Well, but that's the hard part. Because, again, the pain switch to the back is on in the brain, and you feel it in the back. That's the hardest part for people to understand, is that when you are anxious and upset, your body chemistry changes. Every organ system has a different response. So the smooth muscles, like, for instance, your migraine headaches, irritable bowel, spastic bladder, those organs' reactions to a fired-up nervous system. With musculoskeletal system, it's like tendonitis, back pain, etc. With the nervous system, it's tingling in the hands and the arms, burning in the feet. With fibromyalgia, again, the sensitivity is way off. The rheostat's way off. So what happens is that when you're agitated, it's like driving your car down the freeway in third gear. Your body's revved up. It stays revved up. And things simply start to break down. So it's not that hard to understand that this is not imaginary symptoms, that, for instance, people have panic attacks. You know, those are pretty uncomfortable. I've been through those myself, and many people have. Your heart races, you think you're going to die. That's not imaginary, but where did that come from? So it came from anxiety-producing thoughts. You created body reactions that are chemically chemically and neurologically mediated. So it's not that hard to figure out, really, that your brain simply causes symptoms and vice versa. So that's where my determination to bring this in mainstream medicine is pretty clear. The medical profession is not very open to it. There's about 20 physicians in the country that are open to it. There's also another paper out recently that shows that alternative medicine is more effective in chronic pain than traditional medicine. And what people in alternative medicine do, they're very adept at simply calming people down and relaxing them. So as you calm down the nervous system, your symptoms start to decrease.
Well, Dr. Hanscom, talk a little bit about the process that you go through in taking a look at pain and surgery. It's certainly complicated.
Well, first of all, what happens, it doesn't matter whether it's a structural problem or not a structural problem. No, I'm very, very hyper about making sure there's not a ruptured disc, tumor, infection. So it's my responsibility as a surgeon to make sure there's not something structurally we need to address. Second of all, 90% of symptoms in the body are created by the nervous system, and you are not going to find a source. So with structural problems or soft tissue problems or mind-body syndrome symptoms, you have to calm down the nervous system no matter what. So we found out with our surgical patients, when we calm down the nervous system, our surgical results are better, pain is less, rehab's better. Our results have just been stellar by calming down the nervous system. So as far as people to help you out, I did put in my book a website. I'm sorry, I put access to a website. That's the action plan of the book. Probably 90% of this is self-directed. There's three parts to it. The first part, you simply need to understand the different factors that affect pain. So I outlined five factors. One of them is sleep. The second one is stress. The third one is physical conditioning / inflammation. The fourth one is the goal setting. And the fifth one is medication. I mean, you do need medication to modulate the pain while you're getting better. And so the first step is simply learn about pain. The second step is that every variable needs to be addressed at the same time. So sleep, for instance, could contribute 25%. Stress management could contribute another 30%. Physical conditioning could be another 20%. Right there, you're at about 70-75% success. You could add in acupuncture, another 10%. Chiropractic could be another 10%. So what happens, one treatment alone will not solve the problem. You have to address every variable at the same time. The third part is the patient has to take complete responsibility for their own care. So everybody's situation is unique. Everybody's life is very specific to their situation. So logically, the only person that can actually really solve the problem is the patient themselves. So most patients I deal with, I sort of coach them, cheer them along. They basically look at the book, look at the website. They talk to their primary care physician for sleep. They get to the physical therapist for conditioning. They understand the link between anger, anxiety, and pain and start working on some of the somatic tools, calming down the nervous system. And it's really just a matter of time. It's a very, very high success rate from a self-directed program. That being said, a lot of physicians are slowly coming over to this paradigm, a little bit at a time. But unfortunately, at the same time, the business of medicine is pushing to see more patients in higher volume. And my argument for a long time is if you really want effective medicine, you simply have to talk and listen to your patients. Right now, the whole business of medicine is pushing us the other direction.
And now maybe we have back surgery to partly blame for that.
And that's correct. I mean, surgery, see, the thing is what happens, somehow surgery got laid out there as the definitive answer. Well, again, it's definitive if you can see the problem. It does work beautifully. I mean, there's nothing more rewarding than doing a successful spine surgery. It's like fixing a painful tooth, which is horribly painful, too. So it's incredibly rewarding fixing a structural problem. But somehow, when everything else has been tried, we're going ahead and doing these surgeries on normal spines for people's age. It just doesn't make any sense. And I'm seeing an increasingly number of patients the last 5 years, particularly the last 24 months, of having very, very major multiple-level fusions done on normal spines. And the results are pretty catastrophic. People do horribly. Some of these people are in their 30s and 40s. I mean, they're very, very young. They have another 30, 40, 50 years to live with horrible pain the rest of their lives. And it's just a disaster.
That is so shocking. Well, Dr. Hanscom, in preparation for our conversation today, I came across a new word or a new specialty, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about it. It's called physiatrist.
They're a group of rehabilitation doctors, and their whole goal is to maximize your function based on what you have. And a friend of mine, Dr. Stan Herring, was one of the pioneers in using physiatrists to deal with back pain and musculoskeletal pain. Historically, they rehabilitated spinal cord injuries and strokes, et cetera. But also, he went into the process of chronic pain and chronic disease where you have a certain amount of disability. How do you maximize your function? How do you minimize your pain, et cetera? So I came out of my fellowship very aggressive doing spine surgery. I mean, I did dozens and dozens of fusions on back pain because that's what I was trained to do. So I'm not being critical of individual surgeons for doing the operation, because that's exactly what we're trained to do. Nobody really has taught us anything differently. We're encouraged to do the surgery. Discouraged, you know, people really want us to do the surgery, sort of validates their pain. And it was working with Dr. Herring and his partner, Dr. Weinstein, I gradually understood that there's a lot of other parts of pain besides just surgery. And I also started noticing that my surgical results were much better in his patients than other patients. So I work with a team of rehab doctors or physiatrists. I also work with a team of mindfulness-based psychologists. I work with the pain center, who specializes in more difficult situations. I deal with drug addiction specialists to help stabilize medications. I work with sleep specialists. So most people can do it by themselves, but what we've done, we've developed a whole cadre of resources. My hospital's been very excellent in developing the resources. And again, as patient-directed, we become the coaches and cheerleaders, and of course, just medications, et cetera. By using a multi-pronged approach to pain with the patient in charge, it's just, I'll use the word, magical. I mean, we have hundreds of patients that are literally pain-free. It's not about managing pain, it's about getting rid of pain. It's a shifting process off of pain pathways into non-pain pathways. It's a step-by-step process. We do with anxiety first, then anger. Then you switch into a proactive mode. You stabilize it. Then the last part, you can call it the rich, full life, spiritual journey. Whatever you want to do is you get your perspective back. You start interacting with friends, good wine, good food, good friends. Get your and what you're doing, you're shifting off these obsessive negative pain pathways, and people in chronic pain become very, very socially isolated, and you get back into real life. And at the end of the day, it's about connecting with the best part of who you are. It's not a formula. It's sort of a guidance in principles, but it's not a formula. That being said, there's some basic somatic tools to start with. I think you asked me earlier on in the conversation about how do you start the process. And so there are some basic tools that we start with.
So if someone is hearing this and says, well, you know, I'm going to give that a shot, where do they begin?
Well, again, I think that I did write the book called Back in Control, A Spine Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. It actually reflects my personal journey out of severe chronic pain, which I had for 15 years, with seven of those I would describe as intolerable. Then there's a website called back-in-control.com. That's the action plan of the book. On the homepage, there's a Getting Started section that outlines a couple of videos. Then there's some writing exercises, which starts the process. And since, again, pain pathways are permanent, you have to reroute around those. And we use what's called somatic tools of connecting thoughts with physical sensations. That starts creating new pathways. There are an infinite number of ways of getting better and using the tools. The one starting point has been the simple writing exercises that came out of Harvard in 1987, where simply write down your anxiety-producing thoughts, you throw them away. And you're throwing them away not to get rid of them, because they are permanent pathways, but you can write with absolute freedom. So the more difficult and dark the thoughts, the more powerful the process. And writing is actually a very complex neurological process, taking abstract thoughts and turning it into physical sensations. So again, what the writing does, it does awareness detachment in one move. In other words, you separate from these circuits. The reprogram can be mindfulness, meditation, relaxation, music, art. There's an infinite number of ways to reprogram the brain. The problem with a lot of programs right now is that they go right to the reprogramming tools, but you really have to engage the negative thoughts first. In other words, you have to engage and let go before you can move forward. If you're trying to move forward without engaging what's holding you back, you really can't move forward.
It sounds like these lessons really could apply to so many other parts of life, which many cases, I suppose, manifest themselves in pain. But, you know, these kind of things take hold in digestive problems and you name it. It's a lot in life that is impacted by this, isn't it?
Well, every human being has anxiety. You know, it's a survival characteristic. Again, to me, it's a mental reflex, really a neurological issue, not a psychological issue. In other words, something causes anxiety and you immediately react. And what you're doing with the writing and different reprogramming tools, you're putting a little bit of space between the situation and the reaction. In other words, stress isn't the problem, it's the reaction to the stress. Once you can see your automatic reaction, I'm not into positive thinking, which only suppresses negative thinking, but I'm into positive substitution. In other words, that response wasn't very helpful. Let's choose another one. And it's that cognitive choice, that volitional choice over repetition that starts creating new actual neurological circuits. The term we use is neuroplasticity, which I'm sure you've heard a lot of here recently, that we do know the brain actually changes shape and actually, first of all, the brain actually shrinks in chronic pain. That's been documented. When you treat chronic pain successfully, the brain actually re-expands. So we know the brain is incredibly plastic, much more than we thought even 5 years ago. It's remarkable how much. So you're actually restructuring your brain. You're actually changing the structure of your brain.
And that plasticity, is that a positive characteristic, particularly for people over 55?
Yeah, you can. It happens at any age. And it's they think it decreases some over 55 or 60, but not so much. I mean, we don't really know that. I mean, there's lots of sort of assumptions that have been proven wrong over and over again. So I honestly don't know the answer to the question, nor do I think anybody does. But, you know, if you choose to engage in a negative habit pattern, let's say chronic anger, for example, of course, your brain gets that circuit embedded very, very fast. The problem with anxiety compared to an athlete or an artist learning a skill is anxiety and pain come in like a machine gun. And so we think pain pathways and anxiety pathways are laid down permanently in about 3 months. And of course, people live longer than they did. The average lifespan in 1940, the average lifespan in 1950 is only 47 years old. So our population lives an average of 30 years longer than they did in 1950. So we have another 30 years for anxiety circuits to increase. And a lot of older people are really, really anxious. And nobody's taught them how to reroute these pathways. So just with repetition and time, anxiety always gets worse with time. And the tragedy is such a preventable and solvable problem.
That sounds like the subject of another book.
I do have another book that's about half done. It's called The Curse of Consciousness. And I personally think there's only one mental health diagnosis, and that's anxiety. I think that every other diagnosis is a constellation of symptoms around anxiety. And to me, anxiety is the DNA of the human existence. And once you understand how it works, you get the correct diagnosis, it's just not very hard to deal with. I mean, you can't control anxiety. In other words, you try not to think about something, you have it become more of a problem. You learn to live with anxiety. You learn to lose it less. As you use it less, why it becomes somewhat dormant compared to when you try to struggle with it, fight it, fix it, it becomes stronger. You're wrestling with the devil. So as you learn to shift off of these pathways onto non-anxiety pathways, non-pain pathways, pretty soon anxiety pathways just become less strong, and they're always there. If you didn't have anxiety pathways, you wouldn't survive. What happens, you learn to live with anxiety. I don't like the word embrace anxiety because it's still unpleasant, but it is a necessary part of the human experience, and there's no shortcuts around it. And once you learn to live with it, I mean, I had what's called a full-blown obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is the ultimate anxiety disorder. There's nothing worse in the human experience than raw anxiety. It's just like a branding iron on your brain. I had no idea it was coming. I did not become a major spine surgeon by having anxiety. The first symptom I had anxiety was panic attacks. I'm going, what's this? So I was so good at suppressing anxiety, I had no idea it even existed. I didn't know anxiety existed until my body started to react. So people say, I don't have anxiety, I'm not angry. Well, guess what? They have stomach pain, they have irritable bowel, their ears ring, they have migraine headaches, they have all these bodily symptoms, but they don't have anxiety. Well, your body will not let you get away with it. It's not humanly possible. So, yeah, you may not feel anxiety, you may not feel angry, you may have totally suppressed it, but guess what? You're in my office with chronic pain. So your body will respond somehow to unexpressed anxiety and frustration.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'd love to do that. We're actually reached the end of the time that we allocated for this, and it's really been fascinating. And maybe the next time we talk, we can pick up on that other topic.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk. You know, I'd love to do this many times at the airport. I'm always up for doing this. So, I mean, there's a bunch of other different topics you can go into. Like, I think right now I'm seeing a tremendous problem with chronic pain on families. It's just horribly abusive what anxiety and pain does to the family unit. I think that's one of our biggest problems in society right now is that one in three adults have chronic pain, and of course, it's just abusive to their family, and it's horrible about carrying it into the school system, et cetera. So there's a bunch of, if you go into the website, there's a whole bunch of topics you can literally stick on for half an hour each and go into depth on, and I'd love to do that.
Sounds great. Well, Dr. Hanscom, again, I thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating, and I know if anyone can learn as much as I just did, their life has been improved.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for listening to our BloomerBoomer.com podcast. We provide transcripts for most of our podcasts, and you can also access all of our podcasts on iTunes. Oh, and we encourage you to leave a comment in the podcast reply section. Thanks again.